You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Warwick Cato, so I'm Science Strategy Manager at Balance Agri-Nutrients.
Brilliant. And what is Balance Agri-Nutrients?
Well, Balance Agri-Nutrients is a farmer-owned cooperative. So basically, most farmers, pork, veggie, sheep, beef, dairy, basically own us. We're a New Zealand-only business. And in terms of New Zealand, effectively, you have a duopoly. So you've got us and Ravensdown, which is effectively a duopoly. And what we do is we've got two manufacturing superphosphate plants, which is where the rocks use, one here in Mount Maunganui and another one at Awarua near Invercargill. So we make the product superphosphate, which is where that rock's used.
Right. And in terms of you, because I contacted Ravensdown, but how does that work? Do you guys work together or...? It's competition, right?
It's very much competition, yep. So the two co-ops evolved from little regional co-ops. So I originally started in the Southland co-op. So Southland Bay Plenty merged and Ravensdown is there. But effectively, it's a duopoly, largely overlap, similar infrastructure, but we compete quite aggressively domestically.
Mm.
But because we use have the same types of product offering, it's a bit like the two supermarkets, you know, because we have a similar product offering, we have the similar raw materials that we use.
So you said you're a science advisor, was that right?
Science strategy manager.
Right. And what does that look like day to day?
That's a really interesting question. Because I've been in the business for 30 years, I get involved in a lot of things. So, for example, at the moment, Zero Carbon Bill, the David Parker's freshwater announcements, I get involved in lots of those discussions in terms of thought leadership about how do we address those problems, how does nutrient management, how do nutrients themselves fit into resolving and achieving those water quality outcomes and climate change outcomes. And then I also have some science roles in terms of innovation, in terms of what sort of products do we offer in the next 5 to 10 years and thinking about those.
So is that in terms of developing, I guess, strategies, like it says, strategies to deal with those changes and actually how we're addressing?
How do we reduce, so particularly a good example is how would we reduce our environmental footprint? And so how do we know nitrogen, phosphorus impact water quality, you know, how can we change how nutrient management's done? What sort of products would they need? But equally the type of advice that they need, whether you're a horticulturalist, a veggie grower, or a sheep and beef dairy, you know, tailoring that advice. And because we have a range of climates from the west coast and the south, I'm not sure where you're from.
Auckland.
I know you're Auckland University, but where you originate from. But, you know, the west coast of the South Island versus Canterbury versus Bay of Plenty, the soils and the climates are all slightly different, and therefore you have to tailor the solutions for those situations.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for that explanation. So I guess the next big question is what actually is phosphate?
Phosphate is an element. It's one of 14 essential elements that living things use, but it's a very important one because phosphate is what is used to make bones and teeth, and so they are made of calcium phosphate. And the other thing that phosphate's used for is it's a molecule, there's a thing called ATP, which is a molecule that holds and helps energy be used at the cellular level in living organisms. So phosphate is really critical for life and the building blocks of life. And so what happens is if you go to places like Morocco, Western Sahara, China, what have you, millions of years ago, fish and ancient creatures died and went to the sea floor. And it's their bones and teeth that we now grind up and use as the source of phosphorus that we recycle now to make humans' teeth and bones and that in the future, and mammals, and make milk. So it's an essential element.
In the sense that once it's consumed by the animals,
yep,
it ensures that they have strong teeth and bones, and therefore when we consume it, it goes into us and we have strong teeth and bones?
That's well, yeah, but it needs calcium, and interestingly enough, what makes them strong is they're actually, fluoride makes that molecule quite strong, and so the rocks you use, actually the reason they form rocks is there's a trace of fluoride in them, which is why obviously fluoride's part of making strong teeth. It actually helps bind that chemistry, because otherwise phosphorus rocks can be really soft, but sometimes fluoride makes them a wee bit stronger, and so that's why that. But essentially, it's the building blocks of life, really.
Mm. Okay, and so what interest, I suppose, does New Zealand have in phosphate? You've sort of answered that, but why is New Zealand so keen on it?
Yeah. Okay. So good question. So New Zealand soils basically are very poor in phosphorus, sulfur, some in potash, a lot in selenium and micronutrients. So our soils are very young and lack a lot of those nutrients. And we, apart from some phosphorus deposits across the Chatham Rise there, which are relatively small, New Zealand has no deposits of phosphorus or sulfur of any magnitude, and so therefore we have to import that to make our pastures grow. Now, the reason we use it is, importantly, and this leads a wee bit, Lily, into why we make superphosphate, is our pasture, because of our climate and our soils and the rainfall that we're getting today, for example, it's really important for legumes, white clover in particular, and white clover needs phosphorus and sulfur. And essentially, New Zealand makes superphosphate because our agricultural system relies on the role that white clover and legumes play, and they need phosphorus and sulfur. Whereas you go to other countries around the world, they don't. They don't rely on legumes. They use, and therefore they buy nitrogen in a bag, and they use it. So they have quite different fertilizer they use. So when you think about the rock, why we use it, our soils are deficient in it, and the reason we use it in a formulation called superphosphate is because the plants need phosphorus and sulfur.
And in terms of our soil being deficient in it and that being a problem, that's only a problem because we rely so much on pastoral farming, yes?
No. Well, the demand is because we do pastoral farming or vegetable cropping or horticulture for that matter, so they all need it. But the reason they need it, and if you go to Europe, you'll see they talk about a thing called the circular economy over there. And the reason New Zealand can't is challenged in the nutrient space in terms of a circular economy, so not having to use it, is because we export 90% of what we grow. So our meat, our milk, kiwi fruit, avocados, you know, most of that's exported. And so if I use the supermarket analogy, if people go to the supermarket and buy their fruit and veggies and go out the door, eventually the shop will be empty. They need something coming in the shop to stock the shelves. And it's basically because New Zealand exports 90% of what we produce that it's leaving the country, so you have to replace it. And water and air doesn't contain nutrients, so therefore you have to bring fertilisers in to replace the nutrients you've exported.
But in terms of in terms of pastoral farming or whatever ways in terms of farming, but pastoral farming in particular, right, we are uniquely reliant on this because that's the way that we do it.
That's right.
Countries don't actually do it like we do it.
Correct. And it's soils, climate. Yeah, that's right. And because of that, we do. There are other little pastoral places in the world, but because of our geography and, you know, we get the rain and our temperate climate, it suits legume-based farming systems.
But is there an opportunity to sort of do it in a different way?
Well, that's quite an interesting question. You can't replace the nutrients. So let's say they went to potato growing or strawberry growing, they'd need different quantities of the nutrients because they're exporting off the property different volumes in the strawberries or in the goat milk or in wool or other things. So the amount of the nutrients that the growers and farmers use changes depending on how much leaves the gate. And so we use a tool called Overseer, which is basically a budgeting tool in terms of nutrient flows on farms and primary sector properties. And so basically what we do is we do a balance sheet when we go onto the farm using a tool like that and change the amount of nutrients the customer wants based on what that balance sheet shows.
So my question is more like if we were to move away from pastoral farming and the amount of that we do, right? Like in terms of this being one of our biggest, the agricultural sector being one of the biggest things that we do in Port, like you've just described, if we were to move away from that and therefore there would be less to farm, would that mean that we would have to, we could import less phosphate?
Yes.
Just black and white, yes.
Yep, but simply, so if you go to a less intensive farming system or a different farming system that requires less nutrient to replace it, then you could use less. Or equally, on the contrary side, you could go to a non-pastoral farming system that potentially needs more, like potatoes, for example. So you're quite right. If we changed our pastoral system, the quantity and the timing of the nutrients would change. But ultimately, living organisms take nutrients with them when they leave an orchard or a farm. So ultimately, they still have to be replaced in some shape or form.
And so is that, you know, reducing the intensity in which we farm, is that like something that you consider?
Yeah, reducing the intensity of farming. So that's a really interesting question. The change that's happening in farming now is about reducing the footprint of farming. So, you know, I've been in the sector for 30 years, And the early days were really about how do you increase productivity and absolute production. The change that's happening now, and particularly the announcements around zero carbon bill and the freshwater announcements that David Parker's made, what they're going to change now is farmers can essentially do what they like and growers, for that matter, can do what they like on their property, but they must do it within the constraints of the footprint. So you could have 1,000 cows on a property, but you must meet this footprint that society and the environment deems as acceptable. And so that's the premise on a lot of the regulations, how they're getting set up now, is that what we want, and this is a contrast with Europe if you want me to comment on that, but essentially what we want is we and the regional council rules set up and say you must constrain your N and P losses and longer term your greenhouse gas footprint to X or Y, and that's your limitation. It doesn't matter what you're doing on the land. It's the impact you have on the environment that's the limitation.
Right, and so like you said, okay, if we had 1,000 cows, for example, let's just use that as the ratio.
Yep.
That, like, no matter what we do, no matter how we farm that, is over the threshold, right?
No.
But I'm just saying, hypothetically, right, if 1,000 cows was over the threshold no matter what you did, isn't it just, I mean, it just makes sense to drop how many cows we have?
Yeah, on the premise that you're sticking with the existing farming system, so the way that they're grazing outside.
So most
of the nutrient loss comes from the fact they're grazing outside. So if you go to Europe, they house their animals. So most of the footprint comes from the dung and the urine and the belching in terms of greenhouse gases. So if you have them in a glass house where you captured all the dung and urine, then you could manage that. And that's what they do in those overseas countries. The dilemma New Zealand has is the position we like is to have our animals outside grazing, and unfortunately they defecate and urinate outside. And so one way that farmers, and Canterbury is a good example, you might recall the Mackenzie Country Dairy Farm that was very controversial a few years ago. Their way of eliminating that intensity footprint was housing the animals all the time and bringing the feed to them and feeding them in a barn, but it wasn't seen as socially acceptable, so it didn't get through. So you can do it, but by taking the animals off the pasture and putting them in a housed context.
And then that would reduce, and you could have the 1,000 cows because you're still under the threshold.
That's right.
In terms of social acceptability, though, I mean, you could say that killing cows at all is not socially acceptable, right?
Yes, you could, and people do say that.
And so in terms of the extremes of that, housing them is is more extreme.
Yes.
So is that on the cards, though? Is New Zealand considering that as an option?
Essentially, what's happening now in terms of how farms are farmed, there's two issues. There's the social license to operate, which comes from the items you buy in the supermarket. So do you want free-range bacon, free-range chicken, eggs, free-range milk and dairy? So you have that. So there's the consumer who will actually determine that, Lillian. And then the other side is the regulatory framework that says you may well be doing a socially unacceptable practice, but it's the end, and it's the footprint in terms of impact on the environment. So there's two levers driving what the farmers do. And you're seeing that response now. Your market forces are changing the way farmers are doing that. One of my roles is a national judge on the Farm New Zealand Farm Environment Awards. So I travel the country once a year, seeing these farms, and I've been doing that for 8 or 9 years. And what you're seeing is farmers are responding to those social signals. So the way they look after their staff, the way they look after their cows, the way they graze, the way they protect waterways has changed. Much like other societal things change, like, you know, the anti-smacking, tobacco, drink driving, those societal changes, and farmers are effectively doing the same thing. But the problem a lot of them have is in their businesses, how do they change, and is it a fad, and do they just change? So often the cry from farmers is, scientifically, are we doing the right thing? Yes, we want to change, but is it the right thing, and will it achieve the outcome that people are wanting? And what you find is when they get that certainty, and then they also say, well, how do I actually do it? And this is the other problem you find is farmers say, well, yeah, I'd like to do it, but can you point to me to other farms that are doing it so that I can avoid making those mistakes and make sure I do it successfully? Those are probably parts of the impediment in terms of the rate of change that people want.
Yeah, and so in that sort of long-term slow process of change, it's definitely happening, and particularly too when there is reduced demand for meat, for example, the farmers kind of have to respond accordingly, or the sector has to respond accordingly. And if there was that reduced demand, there might be a day where we only have 500 cows. So then, again, we would have less phosphate. What do those farmers then do as a job?
Yeah, well, that's right. And so I come from South, and if you haven't picked that up already. And so I saw that with... I've seen the changes where in the 1980s, arable was the boom industry. Then that went down. Then suddenly wool was the boom industry around the 1990s. And then wool collapsed, the market, and so interestingly, the commentary you hear around air meat and air milk is environmentally friendly and it's a great natural product. You heard those same things about claims around wool in the 1990s, but because synthetics had better functionality, they displaced wool. And the same strategic threat potentially arises with red meat and milk. You know, if these alternatives do provide superior benefits for the consumer and for the environment, then consumers will change and farmers will adapt and they'll find alternative land uses. And so some of that was changing from sheep and beef because of the collapse in the lamb and the wool prices. They converted to dairy. But equally, what you're finding now is people are looking at dairy and say, do I go to dairy goats or sheep milking, or do I convert to kiwi fruit? So around us in Tauranga, Te Puke and the Waikato, farmers are saying, what else can I do that has a different footprint? And they're looking at alternative crops and kiwi fruit. We're seeing a lot of avocados going up in Northland. So farmers are economically rational. They will respond to those signals, and they will look for alternative. So you will definitely see change happening.
Yes, and like I said, that change is happening, but it is a sort of more slow. So I'm going to just shift focus here, and can I get you to just explain to me your understanding of the political situation in Western Sahara?
So understanding of the Western Sahara situation is that it's very complicated. It's been going on for decades, you know. It's reached an impasse between Morocco, Algeria, Polisario and Mauritania, and it's very complicated. The UN's been trying to resolve it for decades, and essentially New Zealand through MFAT, I know Jacinda Ardern's been to one of the refugee camps, so they're trying to resolve that situation. It's very complicated, and there's diverging views on it, and it's very, very difficult situation.
And that difficult situation is obviously felt, the most sort of impact is probably being felt by the refugees affected by the situation, right? So it's currently occupied by Morocco, and as part of that invasion, tens of thousands of people were displaced and are now living in refugee camps in the desert in very desperate conditions. And it's one of the most protracted refugee situations worldwide, like you've just said. It's gone on for a very long time. So just for listeners who might not be aware of that situation, I'm just going to describe what that looks like in terms of refugee camps. So the food and aid supply has declined. Infant mortality is double that of Europe. Water, which is delivered once a month, is limited to 10 litres per day. So that's no running water. They have to ration that. Electricity is sporadic. The land is dry and they only have a few goats, sheep and camels. And then in July, the temperatures are about 43 degrees. So the only shade that they have is tents and mud houses that they've built. The World Food Programme estimates that around 77% of refugees' food comes from international donations which are shrinking over the past several years, and jobs are practically non-existent, and in the absence of employment, boredom and crime and the threat of radicalisation, young people, that's what they're growing up with. There are also accusations of forced disappearances, torture and human rights abuses are rife in the camp. So, I mean, I could go on in that sense, but I'm sure you are aware of this. And I'm wondering how that makes you feel, Warwick.
So our position, or Balance's position, is that the UN is the right place to resolve those issues. It's not something that It's out of scope of what Balance's influence and control is. We recognise the refugee issues. We recognise the impasse that's there. And in our meeting with ministers in Wellington and MFAT and our due diligence, we recognise it needs to be resolved. So agree with what you're saying.
Absolutely. And with respect to UN and the government, I understand that they are doing their jobs as they need to. But I, as a human, I guess I'm asking how that makes you feel, that these people are living in these conditions.
Well, as a personal view, yeah, I have empathy to what's happening in the air. And my personal view is I wish it would be resolved. And what's happened more recently is the UN is finally getting some traction in terms of resolution, particularly when they changed their annual mandate to a six-monthly mandate. So in 2008, the UN finally got those parties together. They've been in an impasse for probably 7 years to actually start getting some movement and trying to resolve the issue.
So, while the UN does do that, again, the UN also on their in their charters, they've got certain principles regarding non-self-governing territories, which would be the Western Sahara in this case. And so, I quote from them that the interests of the inhabitants of these territories are paramount, and they accept as a sacred trust the obligation to promote to the utmost within the system of international peace and security the well-being of the inhabitants of these territories. So and there are a number of principles that are regarding actually their sort of social, political and economic circumstances.
That's right. So and the UN guidelines for non-self-governing territories, it's about promoting economic advancement, it's about non-discriminatory work environment, it's about operations being conducted rationally and sustainably. Balance endorses that 100%. And so what we do is we have 40 criteria when we go and visit suppliers that we actually go over there, and in terms of Balance's area of control and influence, we actually audit and do due diligence on that. Our CEO and our board members go over there at least annually. They've been to Western Sahara a number of times to actually see what those impacts are and what those benefits are, and so they actually get exposed. They've seen that firsthand in terms of the development, the community support, environmental initiatives, healthcare, as they see that. and the money goes into a non-Moroccan account. It goes into FOS Bukhara, which is a separate account which runs a foundation which actually delivers that. And so in terms of the ability that we can control, we believe both ethically and legally that we're operating within the UN guidelines in terms of trading. In fact, to the point that earlier this year, the European Parliament reduced its tariffs on Western Sahara to specifically encourage trade for the benefits of the local people. And so we support that. And ultimately, we are concerned about the moral and ethical issues that are going on in Western Sahara. We raise that with OCP when we do that. We do our due diligence when we go over there. And our way to reflect change is to make sure our transactions with them deliver those societal outcomes that you've specifically spoken about. The more protracted issues around self-determination, governance, the Polisario, who's a Sahrawi and how self-determination is exercised through the vote, it's been an impasse, is something that our government needs to deal with and through the United Nations. And we encourage those that work to continue and that activity to carry on.
Right, but what has been made clear that by the Sahrawi's people, the refugees whose right to govern their own land has been removed by Morocco, right? And what I'm hearing from them is that they don't want countries to take phosphate from their land while Morocco gets the profit. They don't want this happening while this conflict has not been resolved, essentially. And so you're saying that there is no, or you don't, you know, like New Zealand or the companies here don't have the power to kind of do anything. The power that you do have is not to trade with Morocco.
So we trade with a number of countries, and the reason, and there's some reasons why we trade with Western Sahara specifically in terms of the type of rock that they have, and we talked a wee bit about superphosphate earlier, about the need for that. But again, there's very conflicting views, there's very diverging views, as you would have noted when you do some homework on that. And essentially, that's why we have to take our guidance, ultimately, from MFAT, from the United Nations, in terms of who do we transact with. You know, we transact with Vietnam, with China, with South Africa, with Peru, ranges of countries. In terms of our sphere of influence and control, we have those issues in terms of our purchasing criteria. We do that as part of our due diligence, and to say, are we ultimately having a beneficial footprint in terms of what our purchasing behaviour? And Western Sahara is one of a number of countries where we actually specifically deal with that. We empathise with what you're saying, but it's outside the mandate of our business to actually have a position on that. That's for governmental entities to deal with, and all we can do is keep them briefed on what we're doing, why we've, what our auditing is doing and discovering. So, and that's about the extent of where we're at.
Right, and like you say, though, you deal with a number of different countries. So, what is stopping you from only dealing with countries that aren't involved in this sort of conflict?
So we deal. So, for example, there are other countries you can look at. One is Togo, for example. We can get the phosphate rock. So if we go back to the superphosphate, you need that rock. It's very high in cadmium. So that creates a domestic health issue in New Zealand. If we accumulate cadmium in soils, it creates a trade issue in terms of our ability to actually sell our produce to the EU. And the deposit only has a 10 or 15 year life. So so that is an example of other deposits. We don't actually just use Bukhara rock. We do try and use alternative rock sources to make our superphosphate, but you can't use a single source. It's a bit like making a meal. You have to have a range of ingredients to do that. The Bukhara rock from Western Sahara has a high phosphorus, has low cadmium, and it's a soft sedimentary rock. So it's actually a critical ingredient to actually making superphosphate. And a lot of other countries have stopped using that rock because, as we talked about earlier, they don't rely on legumes in their farm systems. So they don't need the sulfur. They're chasing nitrogen. And so their product mix is quite different. Because of their legume-based pastoral system and their dependence on superphosphate, That's why we need the rock mix that we do, of which the Buckra Rock is one of those deposits. And we do the same due diligence on those other rock supplies that we do on the Western Sahara deposit.
I just want to touch on that, though, because there are people that are saying that there are alternatives completely from superphosphate, right? So what about reactive phosphate rock?
Yeah, well, reactive phosphate rock generally doesn't meet the cadmium limits that we have in New Zealand. That's why that's not an alternative rock mix. So, and agronomically, it doesn't perform. So there are some customers that use that, but it actually doesn't. It's not of broad utility across New Zealand. So, again, it doesn't have wide use.
But in the sense that it is a possible alternative, would you be actively kind of working on developing that alternative and making it?
Well, we do actually offer RPR for sale. We do have that one of our product mix, but it only suits certain climates and certain farm systems. And most importantly, it's very difficult to access as well. So when you had the revolutions across North Africa, some of the best rock supplies you can't access. But equally, if I go back to this cadmium limit, the issue with rock supplies is you have so many things that you have to manage in terms of odour, cadmium, dust, fluoride, and all those things come into the mix. And so it's a wicked problem that we're dealing with, Lillian. So it's very challenging to do that. But our business continually looks at that and it's a procurement strategy.
Right.
And if alternatives were available, then we would certainly be using them.
Well, because, I mean, phosphate is a finite resource, right? So it's not even necessarily sustainable if we're thinking long, long term. So what are the plans, you know, for when that runs out?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So there are hundreds of years of phosphate deposits still available around the world. So,
But the majority of those are in the Western Sahara and Morocco.
That's right. That is Saudi Arabia of the phosphate rocks. There's some deposits in Central Australia, but there's no way to obtain them at the moment. So there is a dependence on that belt through North Africa, through into Syria, Israel, Jordan. So there's a belt of rocks through there of varying grades. So ultimately, there's a dependency on Morocco, Western Sahara in the long term. It's a strategic issue for New Zealand about fertiliser supply. As I mentioned earlier, we don't have natural supplies of potassium, sulphur or phosphorus, and so it's a strategic issue for New Zealand to ensure we can keep to access those raw materials.
Well, if that is a dependency, then shouldn't we be actually moving away from that dependency? Shouldn't we be coming up with alternatives? And if that means dropping from 1,000 cows to 500 cows, you know, are we considering this?
Yeah, so the dependency on fertiliser is an interesting one. Balance has spent a lot of money looking at microbial inoculants, for example. So phosphorus and sulphur, when we use them, they do build up and get bound in the soil. We are looking for alternative strategies. We've just launched a product called SureFos, which is a way to try and reduce the runoff from fertilisers. So we spend several millions of dollars a year trying to look for alternatives that are more efficient and improve the efficiency of not only phosphorus but nitrogen. So I agree. And part of my role is actually to have that horizon to say, how do we make them more efficient? How can we reduce our dependency on that? Because it's farmers' largest, well, outside debt servicing, it's one of their largest costs is fertiliser. So our customers would love us to actually reduce the dependency, and if we could do it, we could.
So back to the relationship with the Western Sahara, we are essentially the last country, aside from India, who works through the Moroccan company, but we are the last country that is actually taking this phosphate. So I just sort of don't understand why, when the rest of the world is kind of or has made the statement to stop importing, why wouldn't we want to also be or to make that statement?
Yeah, and it goes back to that issue because other countries don't use predominantly superphosphate and have different pastoral systems to us, so that's why they have alternatives.
But in terms of, so going back to what you said, that this issue essentially is outside the mandate of your business, if we are, you know, I just don't really understand why this is not a consideration that in, yes, it's a complicated issue, but the black and white of it is that people are suffering and ultimately kind of stopping this engagement with that would be making a statement and could possibly, you know, help a UN resolution.
So to probably just wrap up and reinforce the conversation, the issues of self-governance and self-determination and that are outside the balance mandate. That, you know, that's for governments and UN to do that, and we support New Zealand's stance in trying to do that. We have our own self-governing territory in Tokelau, so we have awareness of that here. But the issue for us is under the UN trading rules and the UN and Europe also trades with Narawell, is are we meeting the guidelines for doing that, and are we doing that? And we do our due diligence, and we're comfortable both legally and morally that we're doing that, and that the local people are benefiting from that. And
Again, with the UN, right? So the principles that they have under the non-self-governing territories, B, right, says to develop self-government, to take due account of the political aspirations of the peoples, and to assist them in the progressive development of their free political institutions.
That's right.
Standing in the way of that, isn't it?
Well, that's an opinion. That's a valid view, but ultimately, there's very divergent views around that, and there's, you know, balance's ability to influence us through our procurement strategy in terms of the UN guidelines, and that's about promoting economic development, non-discriminatory work, operational stuff, and we actually go there and do our due diligence to show that we are benefiting the local people. And Marco and our CEO and our board members have been over there numerous times doing that to see that is the outcome. And so we have Sarawai people that actually welcome our trade and doing that, but ultimately we have to do our own due diligence, and we've done that, and we believe that it supports ongoing trade. And the EU moves earlier this year back that up in terms of they are equally doing that.
But your influence, like you say, is not in the UN. Your influence is with your money that you're giving to a particular entity. So if you stopped that, is that something that balance would ever consider?
So we do our due diligence, and when we look at it, we see that the benefits are appropriate.
For New Zealand though, right? We are the ones that are benefiting from this.
No, the local people are, and so ultimately that's what Mark...
In what way?
...and the board do that. Well, we go and see the new schools, we see the reclamation work, the dairy farms are doing, the educational, the universities they're building. We've seen that. We've been over firsthand and seeing what they're doing there, and that's it. And so that's the due diligence the pure procurement team do when they do that, and they're comfortable with that position. And that's why we continue to trade with them.
Have you spoken to the people in the camps? Because there are people in the camps who are still not actually happy, and they're in desperate situations, and they are asking you to essentially divest.
That's a discussion you need to have with Mark, who's actually been over there. I haven't personally been over there myself. I've seen the reports. We've had delegations visit us here, and so that's where it's at. But we will continue to review and do our homework on what's happening over there, and hope that the situation in terms of those other aspects continues to be resolved.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.